gave this talk, similar talk, at a church, not like this one. And I was walking in the back, and there were all these people sitting in the pews, and they pictured me, and I realized, oh, this is what my funeral looks like. This is my funeral experience. Thank you for coming to my funeral. Please remember me as I was, alive. For those of you who don't know, I'm Ryan Northrup like that. I'm the author of Dinosaur Comics, which is comic where it's the same pages with different words. Thank you. I've also written Adventure Time comics for Boom. I've written Squirrel Girl comics for Marvel. There's people who do those. I've done Choose Your Own Adventure versions of, sorry, Choose Your Own Path versions of Shakespeare. Choose Your Own Adventure is a trademark phrase. We did a sequel. Please come in, Chip Zdarsky. We did a sequel called Romeo and or Julia. I've written Jughead. I've written a picture book. I did a Sheen of Death anthology. I did a sequel. That's how you die. There's an author here. Point her out. I agree. But we're here to talk today about my first nonfiction book, which is called How to Invent Everything. And this is how you write a book like How to Invent Everything. So this is the How to Invent Everything talk. And it begins with this gentleman, whose name is Michael J. Fox. He's very handsome. And he's playing Marty McFly in a movie called Back to the Future that came out in 1986, I want to say. I saw it in 86. Blew my mind. I had never encountered the idea of time travel before in my entire life. I was 6 years old. Never thought of this before. And I spent basically the next 15 years thinking about time travel, really obsessing about it. And the thing that I kept coming back to was this idea of, if you go to the future and take a technology and bring it back, you can bootstrap that technology. So if you go to the future, go to the present, start in 2018, 2019, and take a copy of War and Peace, and bring that back in time to the Renaissance and give it to someone else, to Leonardo, and he puts the book out under his name, then when Tolstoy is born hundreds of years later, he's not going to write War and Peace because it already exists. He's going to write a different book, possibly a better book, because he will have read War and Peace, not knowing that he wrote it, and learn from that, learn from his own mistakes. So then I thought, we don't even have to give it to Leonardo. You can easily just take care of this yourself. Put out your own book. And it's not just works of art, it's technology. This is a clip from a YouTube video that claims to be evidence of time travelers in 1938. I love it. I love the conspiracy theory zoom in, the slowed down frame rate. This woman seems to be talking on a cell phone. A time traveler from the future? Gasp. This footage ignores the fact that cell phones aren't magic. They need infrastructure to work. Cell towers, they're garbage. Without a satellite phone doesn't work. It also ignores the fact in the 20s, a popular version of an early hearing aid had you bring it to your ears, you could hear what people were saying, and you just speak back in a way that now looks like you're speaking on a cell phone. But this is the idea of, like, you took technology from the future and brought it back. You could bootstrap technology the same way I was bootstrapping War and Peace earlier. So I had this idea. I wanted to write the most dangerous book in history. If time travel exists, this would be the worst book to leave lying around. And then I went to a bookstore and found that book had already been written. My book would be the second most dangerous book in history. I had this dizzying effect looking at this book in the bookstore and being like, oh my god, what an irresponsible book to publish. Your Benjamin Tiny book will never exist. So I'm used to mainly writing fiction. So I started with the fiction. Well, what do we need to write this book? And I want it to be a survival guide for time travelers. So let's start with the time travel. So we start with, we have time travel, if there's time travel, there's time machines. And if there's time machines, there's probably, like, crappy dirt. Hi, Jen. I'll stop embarrassing people who come in. But if there's time machines, it made me think, like, we have cars now, and there's fancy cars, and there's regular cars. And if you rent a car for really cheap, you get kind of a cruddy car. So what if you have, like, a really cruddy time machine? And what if this cruddy time machine is probably going to break down a lot? And that led me to the idea of, well, let's have a rental market time machine that's kind of cruddy. The next problem is, well, if you're renting out time machines willy-nilly to members of the general public, you've got a problem, because Back to the Future, all these time travel movies are based around this idea that if you change, step in a butterfly in the past, you're going to ruin the present. And so running out of time machines is wildly irresponsible. But put up this version of time travel where you go back in time, and every time you go to the past, you create a new timeline. The FC3000 is what I call the time machine in the book, which is great, because then when you return to your original timeline, no ethical problems, everything's safe, ignoring the fact that you're now, in this version of time travel, creating a new universe filled with people just as real as you, for the purposes of tourism, entertainment, maybe some resource extraction. I was really inspired by airplane books, like these pamphlets you flip through where you don't really read them, you don't expect to crash, there's sort of, you flip through them. I wanted that sort of, that level of importance in the book, where it had to be written for legal purposes, but no one really thinks you're going to need to use it, which would be horrifying if you were trapped in the past and find this book is just sort of like, you know, you're stuck here, but it's fine, don't worry about it. And this was the time machine we came up with. It's the FC3000. I spent a lot of time in my life watching episodes of Star Trek, and they said it wouldn't be useful, but making up labels for the time machine was so easy. You know, to put in a temporal containment reflector, a T-SIM to adjustment core, no big deal. Whip those words out of the problem. So I did a lot of research, and I was reading, and I started, after about 6 months, starting to get nervous because all I had done was research. All I had done was read and take notes. And I started to, as the slide suggests, feel like Batman. If you need to feel like someone, feel like Batman. This is a comic from Batman Year One, who's not yet Batman. He's like, he's worried, he's stuck in his training. And I'll read to you in the Batman voice. He says, I'm not ready. I have the means, the skill, but not the method. No, that's not true. I have hundreds of methods, but something's missing. Something isn't right. I have to wait. I have to wait. And he doesn't have to wait. He's like karate chopping a tree in half. He's ready. He doesn't need a bat costume. So I sort of thought, well, I'll just start writing. I went and basically locked myself in a room and started writing. And so I faced this question. Anyone who has done a large project at some point will face the question of, oh no, if I accidentally decide to do something impossible again. All been there. And the only way to get through it is to realize, no, I've done this before. It's not impossible. It's just really, really hard. And you can work with really, really hard. You just start doing the work, putting the work in. And so I ended up writing about 50,000 words, which is about the size of a small novel, before I realized that what I was trying to do would work. Because I wanted the book to be, like a funny book that you'd read for entertainment, for funsies. But I also wanted B, to be like a legitimate answer to the question of, I'm stuck in the past, what do I need to know to reinvent the future? This is the book I wanted to read, so I had to write it. And it took me 50,000 words to realize that this would work, that there was enough what I call low-hanging fruit in civilization to make it possible to write a book that would actually legitimately let you build civilization. And I started to see this theme across human fiction, which I love, because I was reading a lot of popular science books, and their theme there was basically, humans are smart, look how smart we are, we built these amazing things. And the theme I was seeing was that we're really not as smart as we think we are. And I'll lead you through a couple examples, which I love. This is the Safari icon. It represents a compass. It's hard to find royalty-free art of compasses. So we could have made a compass in 200 BCE. This is when the ancient Greeks first noticed that some rocks stick together. They discovered natural magnets. And they were like, oh, weird, rocks, oh well. And then around 1000 CE, the Chinese actually discovered and built compasses. And these were initially used about 100 years just for fortune-telling purposes, where anyone thought, oh, we could use these to unlock navigating the entire world. So that is 1,200 years. We could have had compasses and didn't. And these first compasses weren't the icon I was showing you, where you have like a tiny sliver of metal balanced on a pin sandwiched between two layers of plastic. They were just basic. If you have a piece of material, a magnetic rock, you have a rock, you tie that rock to a string, the string lets the rock rotate freely, the rock points towards magnetic north, that's your compass. Tying a rock to a string took us over 1,000 years. So the reason I figured we were doing this is because we had the wrong ideas. We had some bad hypotheses, and this bad hypothesis was that some rocks are just weird. Once we got past that, we can invent the compass. And here's another example. This woman's holding a stethoscope. So we could have invented those around 300 BCE when we first started messing around with paper. Actually invented in 1816 CE. And the story here is you had a Victorian doctor who was a heterosexual man, and he had a patient who was a female, and he wanted to listen to her heart, and normally he'd just press his ear to the patient's chest, but she was a busty female, and he thought, well, this is too erotic an experience for me. And so he rolled up a tube of paper to leave some room for Jesus and listened through the tube and for Jesus. Discovered by accident that this tube isolated and amplified the noises he was trying to hear, which leads to discoveries of, oh, the noises that organs make, especially in the respiratory and digestive systems, can be diagnostic and teach us about disease. So a huge medical advance over 2,000 years, where he could have had this and didn't. All he did was roll a piece of paper. And it was actually the only instance I could find in my research of like legitimate scientific progress being made by someone being too horny to do his job properly. thought I thought this paper is boring, and I hate it. This is a great one. These are buttons, obviously. These could have been invented around 2800 BC. This is when humans first started tying pretty shells and nice rocks to their clothing to look nice. We want to look nice in our clothing. Actually invented 1200 CE. This is where we actually add the slit to the other side that allows you to fasten clothes shut. And this revolutionizes fashion because now your clothes can be form-fitting instead of having to fit over your head all the time because you can seal them against your body. So you're looking at 4,000 years. And these are 4,000 years in which we thought we were looking pretty sharp with these nice rocks in our clothes, when actually we looked like idiots who didn't know what a button was. Bad times for humanity. Bad hypothesis. Fashion is never practical. This glass of milk represents pasteurization. So pasteurization is a process of making liquid foods safe. Milk especially, without pasteurization, is one of the most dangerous foods to drink because it carries so much foodborne disease and illness. Pasteurizer is one of the safest foods to have. And to pasteurize, all you have to do is bring this liquid up to the boiling point, just beneath the boiling point, and let it cool. And that's it, you've invented pasteurization. Could have been invented in 10,500 BC when we first started messing around with farming. Actually invented in 1117 CE, in China as a way to preserve wine, and then reinvented hundreds of years later in France by Pasteur, who slaps his name all over it. If you're looking at over 10,000 years to just boil food, because we didn't know what germs were. Bad hypothesis, food goes bad sometimes. Oh well, nothing we can do. I just touched the fingerprint reader, so I don't want to do that. This colorful character represents hot air balloons. Could have mentioned 100 BCE, towards their doing animal fibers, plant fibers. Actually invented in 1783 CE in France by the Montgolfier brothers, who do not know what they're doing. They noticed that hot air rose above a fire, and they thought, aha, we've discovered electrified steam that is powered by a new form of matter called Montgolfier gas. And if we capture this Montgolfier gas in a paper bag wrapped in a burlap sack, that will rise, and we can now create flight. And this is like the dream of humans is classically been to fly. We've looked at birds, we've tried taking feathers to ourselves, jumping off buildings, none of it works. It took until 1783 to just try to capture hot air. So you're looking at 2,000 years. But the first hot air balloon the Montgolfier brothers made, the ones that first actually humans flew in, was, again, not the silk, but like paper and burlap, which is just plant animal fibers. And a single human who knew what they were doing could gather enough of those fibers over the course of his or her life to build a human-scale hot air balloon, which means it's actually the vast majority of human history that we could have been flying and weren't, so we didn't know what we were doing. That hypothesis, maybe going chicken feathers to myself, is the secret. It's not, we know that now. So I wanted the book not just to have technology, but we're trying to rebuild civilization. Civilization is art and music and culture. So now this is a bit from the art section where we provided different art styles. So, you know, you can start with the primitive, but maybe you want to do some surrealist stuff, the scenes on the ship, pop art, just some ideas to build with your civilization. But I was worried because I thought, well, what is an actual technology of art that we can provide that will give people a head start? And it turns out there is one. This is it. Do you know what we're looking at here? What this represents? Perspective. Thank you. You're all advanced humans. Perspective gets discovered or invented in 1413 CE. And when it happens in Europe, people go completely bonkers for it. It's insane. This is before perspective. 610 CE. You might notice that. Like, artists are stupid. They know that things get smaller the further away, but there's no theory behind it. So you look at this, and the stool is going in this direction, the table is going in a different direction. There's five legs on that table. Middle Ages was a rough time. But here's, we figure out what perspective is, Da Vinci goes bonkers for it. This is one of the most famous paintings in the world, Last Supper, that great underneath the doorway, because someone wanted to walk through like a priceless work of art. And if you look at this painting, it's hard to see it because we've all seen it so many times. If you look at this with fresh eyes, this painting is like 30% I love religion and 70% check out my perspective. I have mastered one-point perspective. There's doors on the side. I mean, it's just like baby's first perspective drawing. I love it. It's not just Da Vinci. Here's Raphael around the same time. We've all seen this painting, this school of philosophy. Raphael has learned how to draw 3D cubes. There's a 3D cube. That's a 3D cube. 3D cube. It's really just a flattened 3D cube. These are lengthened 3D cubes. It reminds me of nothing more of just like in the early 90s when we first invented ray tracing, everyone was doing chrome balls over checkerboards. The greatest works in European painting are driven in the 1400s equivalent of chrome balls over checkerboards or like lens flares, which I love. I love that this is the world we live in. This is what bonkers for it. I also put in music. I taught you how to read music, create instruments. And then I put in some songs for you to plagiarize, put your name on it. And I had this big idea where I'd have like some classical works of music. So we'd have like Ode to Joy. We'd have Mozart, one of his songs that I can't think of right now. You know, the real important music in the European canon. And then the last song to plagiarize would be Salt and Pepper's Shoop. So that would be just a great contrast. And the people in charge of Shoop's rights like did not understand what I was trying to do. So you're like, is it a textbook? No, it's something you read for fun. They're like, oh, so it's fiction. Like, no, it's nonfiction, but it's wrapped in a fictional candy coating. It's tangible. They stopped writing back to my emails. So instead of Shoop, I put in Kuburinki, which is actually the Tetris theme song. It's a Russian folk song. And I actually, to avoid getting in any copyright trouble, I got a musician who had never played Tetris, never heard the song, and just played in the folk tune version of it. And he gave me this sheet music to put in the book for you to plagiarize when you're trapped in the past as a basis for your musical civilization. The one other technology we got from music that I thought, like, what's a physical invention we can have? This is it. This is called Hooke's wheel, invented in 1681 CE. So the problem is, if you have sheet music, that just tells you what notes to play. But what does a C note sound like? And if you're a musician, you have some idea, but there was actually an issue where the trend at the time was that higher pitch notes sounded more beautiful. They were thought to be more beautiful. And so you have bands traveling around cities with musicians and singers, and the musicians would be constantly tuning their instruments higher to get more people out until it was exceeding the range of the human voice. So France actually passed a law saying, this is what a C sounds like pitch it down, guys. 1681, Hooke invents this wheel, where basically you see it's kind of a big wheel. It has some smaller wheels, makes a smaller wheel spin quickly. The smaller wheel has teeth on it, so those teeth hit a card every time the wheel spins. If you know how many teeth are hitting your card, how much time is going by, you can calculate how many hits on that card are happening per second, which is actually frequency, it's hertz. And then you have a measure of tones. As you go faster, the tone is. And so, with Hooke's wheel, this is the first time in history that humans produce this sound at a known frequency, and it was used to define what notes sound like. And now, the basic of our music system in North America and most of the world is A440, where an A note is at 440 hertz. You needed this, he invents it, and then within the decade, someone invents tuning forks. So you just piece of metal, shave it off to get the sound you like, done. No longer need this wheel, but this is the first invention needed. So, with Hooke's wheel, you can build the foundation of everything you need in music relied on producing one sound at a known frequency. With this, you can do it. There's foods you want in the past, because you're stuck in the past, you want to have some tasty foods. The thing is, you're going to have some garbage foods, because we've been spending thousands, tens of thousands of years selectively breeding food to make them more pleasant for us. This is an example of corn, first domesticated around 7000 BCE. Modern corn, You know what corn is. It's delicious, peels easily, it's conveniently wrapped. Ancient corn is basically almost a grain. The kernels you have to smash, get into, or peel them. It tastes like a dry, raw potato. So this is some disappointing corn you'll be having if you're trapped in the past or domesticated in. Peach is similar. We have these nice, large, juicy peaches today. In the past, they're very small, much more larger stones compared to the flesh. Waxy skin, it tastes earthy, sour, slightly salty. These are garbage peaches. Watermelon, 3,000 BC domesticated. The earlier ones, you'd have to smash them with a hammer or your fist to get at them. They're high in starch and fat, bitter taste, unpleasant smell. Watermelon is great because we can actually trace, we're still domesticating it, and we're making it better. And because we have this tradition of painting still life portraits of fruit, you can see the development of watermelon in painting. This is a watermelon from the 1600s, Lord Ray. That is a garbage watermelon. But you can see like where we're going with that. Here's later on the same century. It's got a wavier pattern, but there's more of the meat of the watermelon there. Here's 1700s, getting closer, still big seeds and still this swirly pattern. 1813, this is cuts. You can see the melon part of it, where it has that internal structure you used to see in melon that's now completely lost. 1864, we're getting close, still like a lot of black seeds, but we're getting really close. And then modern watermelon, that's just like all the parts we like, little white seeds, nothing we don't like. This has allowed the watermelon to finally reach its full potential, what it was always meant to be. We did it. But the bad news is there's actually some foods you cannot reproduce in the past, no matter how much you know. And one of them is the red grapefruit. Red grapefruit, the one to eat today, every red grapefruit you've probably ever had is descended from an American program called Atoms for Peace. So what happens is, it's the 50s, they've dropped some nuclear bombs, they're like, man, this nuclear power really has a bad rap. We need some positive nuclear power things. What do we do? So they start this, which is a gamma garden. You take some plants, you put a radioactive core in the middle, and put plants in concentric rings going outwards. So the plants closest to the radiation die. The plants furthest away are less effective in the middle. They mutate, and you're basically hoping for a useful mutation, throwing a shotgun at the wall. And one of them was this red grapefruit that stayed red, was sweet, didn't go bad as quickly. We got lucky, and we've been cloning ever since. So to do this, you know, specific radiation-induced mutation, you're not going to be able to duplicate that very easily in the past. I'm sorry. Eat your grapefruit before you go back in time. Another one is, this is the Haas avocado. Basically, again, every avocado you've had is a Haas avocado. They produce fruit year-round. They ship better. They taste better. They're tastier. Look at these are three guys, Mr. Haas, Mr. Rideout, and Mr. Calkin. So Mr. Haas is a guy who's an avocado speculator. And he grows avocado trees, like sturdy bases, and then grafts on branches from other plants trying to produce delicious avocados. So he takes a branch of a tasty avocado and the tree base of a really sturdy avocado and tries to blend the two. So he pays Mr. Rideout to get avocado seeds for him. Let's pick them out of restaurant scraps, find wherever he can. So what happens, Rideout gets Haas a seed, and he plants it, and he grows his avocado tree. And tries to graft something onto it, it doesn't work. So he tries again, it doesn't work. He's like, this is a garbage tree, I'm going to cut it down. Mr. Calkin shows up and says, don't cut down that tree, I have a good feeling about that tree. And then that winter, it starts producing fruit and continues producing fruit year-round, and now we're cloning it everywhere. So without these three guys, a mysterious seed at the right place at the right time, you don't get the modern avocado. And if you're looking for like a pen for time travel, Mr. Calkins is very suspicious in this story. He says, maybe don't cut down that tree. So without the three guys, you're not going to get the avocado. But the obvious sort of question from all this is, you know, what's the most important invention? You're going through all these inventions, you're trying to rebuild civilization. What's the most important invention of all? And in my opinion, it's not this. This is a useful page in the book. This is just a list of the body and organs and what they do, how important they are. Having this page in your prison would make you the most medically advanced human in just about any time period earlier than 300 years ago. Just knowing, you know, blood gets oxygenated in the lungs. You're way ahead of the game. It's not this time. This is the periodic table of elements, which is useful. Also, might be noticing a few extra rows on this. Since it's from the future, I figured they'd find out every element that exists. So I went up to element 172. At element 173, the best models we have suggest the electrons would be, the elements would be so large, the electrons would be orbiting faster than light, which seems impossible. So I cut it there. But the most important invention of all history, I'll walk you through it. It starts around 200,000 years ago with the what's called anatomically modern humans. This is where our bodies finally become modern. They have skeletons that look just like ours. We take an anatomically modern human baby from the past, bring it to the present, raise it as your own child. This kid will grow up to be just as smart and clever and inventive as any other child born today. These have the nature that just need the nurture. But we only become what we call behaviorally modern in 50,000 BCE. So behaviorally modern humans, they start acting like us. They start creating more, they're creating art, they're decorating, they're burying their dead, they're decorating their bodies. They start suddenly become what we describe to be human. So the question is, well, what took us on? What happened 50,000 years ago that didn't happen 200,000 years ago? Because it's not our skeleton, it's not our bodies. What changed? And we don't know for sure, but one of the theories I really like is that we started talking to each other. We invented language. And it's really hard to invent, turns out. In studies with feral children, children who were raised basically by wolves and without parents, if those children haven't learned a language by puberty, they will never learn a language. It's very hard to learn your first language as an adult. You just don't have any use for it. It's hard to learn a second language, too, but if you want to invent a language, and there's no other language involved, you have to not only invent the idea of language, but then instantiate it and teach it to someone else before it has any use. You have to teach it to them when they don't even have a language in the first place. So you can see why this might take 150,000 years to sort of tease apart. And there's actually two parts to inventing language, just talking and writing. Talking, obviously, is great. I'm doing it now. It feels pretty good. It lets you have ideas that can now survive the death of the host. If I die, you might remember what I told you. It allows us to have an oral tradition where ideas can be passed down over time. It's really powerful, but it's not the whole thing. The other half is writing. This is uniform in the first forms of writing. And writing is interesting because we've only really invented it maybe three times in human history. One of the earliest inventions of writing is cuneiform. So there we have it in Mesoamerica, Mesopotamia, and maybe in China. But the earliest Chinese writing looks a lot like Mesopotamian writing, like they were culturally contaminated. And it turns out that the hard part of writing is not the characters you use, or whether you go left to right, or right to left, or top down, or whatever. It's that first idea of turning invisible sounds into visible shapes on a piece of paper or a piece of stone that contains meaning. And that idea occurred to us maybe three times. And writing's great. It allows you to have ideas for the host, but also ideas that survive the death of me and you, and when anyone's ever heard them in the history of the planet, because we can still decipher ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs, and those people are all dead. We can still recover their ideas. This is an example of writing from Easter Island. It's called Rongo Rongo. And that's why I said maybe three times, because we don't know if this is writing or not. We've never been able to decipher it. The story of Rongo Rongo is Spanish people show up on Easter Island. They say, hey, we're here to be awful for 100 years. And the Easter Islanders say, cool, by the way, here's some writing we have. But only the elites can read. Only the high priests are allowed to read and write. So for us, it's just shapes, but for them, they can translate it. And then the Spanish spend 100 years doing slave raids and spreading disease and basically being horrible, decimating, more than decimating, almost collapsing the population of the island. 100 years later, they show up again, and there's no one left alive who can read Rongo Rongo. They know it used to have meaning, but they can't tell you what it is. So this is the invention. If this was language, it was lost. Like, this was the technology we invented on this island as humans and then lost it. And it feels crazy to think that you could lose the technology of writing, but you can. We made it up for ourselves. We don't get it for free. And that's one of the most terrifying things I think that history can show us, that we can lose this stuff. We can lose something as fundamental as writing. So we invented talking in 50,000 BC. Does anyone know when we invented, I guess, when writing first showed up? Earliest invention of writing in those three examples. Any ideas?
6,000?
6,000 would be great. It was actually 3200 BCE, which is 45,000 years between where we could have invented it and when we finally did. If you go back to those earliest Anteleimon agreements, that's 196,000 years. This is where you, as a time traveler, have the single greatest effect on human history. If you go back to those earliest Anteleimon agreements and teach them to talk, teach them to write those thoughts down, teach them to communicate with each other, you'll give every civilization on the planet 196,000 year head start. This is where you can have the results that you're looking for. From all of this, the writing and doing this book, I sort of reached a couple of conclusions. The first was that we're all smart enough to rebuild civilization from scratch, which I was not sure was the case. But it's a lot of it is not that hard. A lot of it is the hard part is having that idea. And so many of these inventions, once you've seen them or you just had them described, you know how to build it. Like a button, it's not tricky. When the Dutch first showed up in Japan after its centuries of isolation, they wore buttons. The Japanese were like, oh, buttons. Of course, done. So like we already carry stuff in our head that could be fundamental in civilizations. And it's not that hard, which I think is great. There's so much low-hanging fruit in history, I was worried that it would be really hard to have enough in the book that would feel valuable, but you can start with just like, here's how crop rotation works, here's some basics of farming, and build your way up to a working computer, like functional computational machinery, in 400 pages. There's a lot that we all can do, which I think is really powerful. And the final thing is, like, no information to do something new. I write Squirrel Brother and Dinosaur Comics. I don't write civilization guides, but there's no one to tell you, here's permission to write civilization guides. So I just started it, started doing it, and it was really empowering. And I feel like, not just, if I was like back in time, I'd be a more competent time traveler, but I feel like a more competent person. Like, I can walk into any room and, with some metal, generate electricity if I need it. That feels good. And that's the talk. Let's do some questions. Oh, let's applaud, please. Yes. Thank you. But let's do some questions. I love to talk about this. Yes.
Have you looked into math? Like, when did we invent math?
Yeah. So,
that would be super important too.
Yeah, there is a table in the book that brings you through basically the mention of numbers. And we can advance 100,000 years in 2 pages. Because it's the story of math, the story of baby steps, where we start with this idea of, well, we can count things. We can count sheep. You have 5 sheep. And then you can do operations. You can add and subtract. But it took us a long time to make the leap from 5 sheep to 5. Like, what is 5? But if you have an abstract idea of 5, you can say 5 minus 4, not have to imagine a sheep, which is a step you need to go to do, like, 5 divided by 4. We get fractions of sheep that don't make sense in the real world. Fractions took a really long time. Real numbers, irrational numbers. You find stuff as late as 1800s. European mathematicians are saying stuff like negative numbers do not make sense. Because how can you have the absence of something? It's just stuff that we take for granted. It took us so long to get there. And again, it's just having that idea and accepting, like, yeah, negative numbers make sense. Some things go up and down. These work really well for that. The thing I love about math is that we base it on these things that we think are true but can't really prove. One of them is, for example, 1 plus 2 is the same as 2 plus 1. It's the associative property. The order of the numbers doesn't matter. Seems obvious, but we haven't found a way to prove it besides just saying this is true. And so you can build up different systems of math just by taking different assumptions. And these systems of math will be entirely consistent. They'll be real as our math, they just don't happen to reflect reality as well as our current math does. Which is, I love the idea of just building your own math and sort of seeing what happens. Yeah?
Is there anything that you really wanted to include in the book, but it's too complex or too strange to try to understand?
Yeah, I wanted to include chlorinating water for safety, because you can boil it, but it'd be nice to chlorinate it. The trick is, there's a very small window between not enough chlorination and your water is still toxic, and too much chlorination and your water is toxic. I feel like I couldn't come up with a way to make that reliable for anyone stranded in the past not to kill their civilization. Now, the other thing that sort of unlocked the bonus slot here, the thing that the question reminded me of is I was reading a lot of survival guides in this book. See, like, when you initially arrive in the past, what you need to know to stay alive. And there are a lot of survival guides that are completely baloney. just like made up garbage. And my favorite was a book that was saying, look, after the zombies attack, then you want to get out of the city. There's too many people there. But after a couple years, go back into the city. There's lots of canned goods and like food in pantries. And don't worry, because food doesn't go bad. It's a government lie. If you think about it, thank you. If you think about it, you know, like when food goes bad, it gets mold. And mold is just, like, that's life. That's life feeding on it. It's fine. You'll be fine. It tastes gross, but you'll be fine. And I was like, that doesn't sound right to me. So I turn the page. It's like, update the second edition. It's like, listen, I ate some fish and I got botulism. So botulism is real. Fish goes bad, but other food is still a government conspiracy to make you buy more food. But she's like, how did you publish it? But it made me realize that these survival guides are inherently pessimistic. It's, in the future, the world's going to go to hell. A guy said, hell in a church. The world's going to go to heck. And you might survive by being smarter and having the most guns. These are like depressing scenarios. Well, the time travel version of that is you're going to be trapped in the past and you have a chance to make it better. And you can always improve on what's going to happen. So I like that I had accidentally written a really optimistic book about being in possibly the worst scenario it's possible to be in, which is stranded alone in the past trying to not die based on what this book is telling me to do. Yes.
And you put a non-fiction
side.
Now that you're done, how do you still feel like fictional
shells are really necessary? Yeah. One of my early readers, I said the book, and he's like, I love the book, but why do you have this fictional shell around it? Why not just call the book Ryan North Explains Cool Science and History Stuff? And I said, well, but I really love the fictional shell. I want to do a new book with the fictional shell again. What I like about it is it's a way in that feels sincere and fun. Like, no one's gonna take you too seriously when you're talking about being stranded in the past with your broken down time machine. Like, it already feels like a fun scenario. And also, in terms of just writing a book and making it entertaining to read, I was worried it would be dry. Like, I was worried I have to explain how farming works and farming is boring. Turns out farming is really cool. I had no idea. But also, it starts the book that whenever I felt like stuff was getting dry, I could throw in a joke about time travel, or I could play with the premise some. And since it was written in the future, that person who was writing in the future had a life and a voice and could sort of be angry at his job writing, you know, books that aren't going to be read for time machines sort of thing. And it made it feel like a much more vibrant way to explore the text than just like, here's what you need to know to produce a Pelton turbine. Ba-dum. I think my publisher was worried because she thought, how are people going to file this book, because it's fiction and nonfiction, and she was worried that, she wanted to be very clear what was fictional and what wasn't, so people wouldn't mistake a joke for reality. And so what we did that was, the fictional stuff is all about time travel, which I believe is not true. Stephen Hawking has a great quote where he says, the greatest proof we're not being, that time travel is impossible, that we're not being visited by tourists in the future. Which I always thought was, oh man, I really hope time was real, but that sort of ruins it. But then for this book, I had that alternate universe version. I was like, oh, now it works. They're just visiting alternate universes. And I used to think, you know, oh, well, maybe there's time visiting our time. Who says our time is interesting? But after like 2016, I feel like they're the time travelers. Checking things out. There's a question over here. Yes?
How does one avoid being murdered as a wizard?
How does one avoid being murdered as a wizard? It's a good question. I feel like let's say you're dropped in the past, pre-civilization, so like 10,000 BCE. You have the challenge that people right now are hunting and gathering. And when it's a time of abundance, hunting and gathering is a fabulous lifestyle. You're just eating fruit, rabbits hop by and into your mouth. Like, it's not a lot of work. Farming is a lot of work. You are working all day long. Just to get this food going. So, if you're in that time period and you start trying to build a farm, I don't think anyone's going to worry, they're going to laugh at you. Look at this idiot. And that gives you the advantage. If you're in a time period that's like 1400s or time when there's a fear of witches, I would recommend not doing the showy stuff. But there's still a way you can improve your, like, even just knowing that germs are a thing, you can produce soap, which is not a showy production at all. It's a very basic thing to do. No pun intended, because it's basic in the pH scale. With soap, you can say, all right, well, wash your hands before you touch anyone else's mucous membranes or mouth. And wash your hands after you touch an animal. And wash your hands if you're sick. And wash your face and body once in a while. And suddenly people who are listening to you are living longer, not getting sick, and not carrying disease. And that might seem like witchcraft, but you can share it so easily. But just like giving soap, I feel like when your benefits are so tangible in a way that witchcraft often isn't, you sort of change from being a witch to being a nice guy who's helping people. So, and I've also been asked, like, you know, if you're trying to invent language, like, you said it's hard to teach, what do you do? And my advice is, well, you should kidnap a caveman baby and teach that baby to talk. And then you can build a civilization out of that. And I feel like that is the most efficient way you're traveling the past. So I don't want to, you know, go on record saying Ryan Orr says you should travel back in time and steal children to start a civilization. But there's decisions to be made that you have to, what kind of civilization do you want to build? Do you want the baby stealing efficient civilization or the... It's up to you. I don't judge, I just write the books. Another question?
Do you put in anything about economics or politics, or do you sort of steer clear of that?
I mentioned when you start, when you invent farming, you invented income equality. Because now you have farmers who have supplies and those who don't farm, who don't have supplies. But you've also invented civilization because you've invented specialization. Once you're not worrying where your next meal is coming from, you're freed up to worry about other stuff, like why do apples fall from trees, or why do they sick sometimes? And we live in a society where, like, I can specialize my whole life on just writing, or people can specialize on weird, esoteric things, but you can get further than anyone has gone before in this field by having more time to work towards it, which you don't get if you're hunting and gathering, or just trying to keep alive all to yourself. So there's pluses and minuses, and I did initially intend to have a section on, like, different political systems. I changed it into a system of different political thoughts. So it's basically a table saying, you know, here's some religious things you might want to borrow, like monotheology, pantheology, and here's some systems of thought that you could build a civilization around. So more of the ethical and moral core than the actual, you know, should you be Republican or Democrat sort of thing. But I was surprised how, when you get back to get down to this, like, fundamental civilization, how apolitical it is. Like, there's nothing political about, I hope it's nothing political about it, but, like, producing soap so people don't die. Or, like, dying of an infection is a suboptimal way to end a life and a suboptimal use of resources. Or, like, the greatest resources you have in your society are human brains, so you want to keep those human brains and the bodies they're attached to healthy and productive for as long as possible. This seems just like baseline stuff. The most trouble I got into was someone who emailed me really mad because throughout the book and this talk I said BCE and CE instead of BC and AD. And it turns out that was Christianity erasure. And he was saying, look, I loved your book, lots of facts, they all seemed accurate to me, but this thing is just inexcusable, and giving you one-star reviews everywhere I can find it. And I was like, okay, this means a lot to you, didn't mean to me, so you do you. But I think when you're doing this fundamental stuff, it is, for the large part, more apolitical. Sorry, that was a long answer to a simple question. Yeah?
I want to start with Stephen King.
Yeah, it was mostly just like synthesizing from the literature. In my life, I have definitely searched for things like how to get rid of a body for a book. And then my next search was, that was for a book. Sort of covering my tracks. I realized, like, it's a perfect alibi. I mean, like, just search how to not murder a body, and then you're clearly not murdering a body. I was home doing Google searches. So I worried about that, but I think that's about as close as I've been to being wrong with this. I think most writers have some very suspicious search history. You want to know the answer? How to grow new bodies? Their advice was to put it in pieces, because one bone is less suspicious than the whole body, which I think is technically true, but like, if I find a skull, I'm still pretty suspicious. I'm like, oh, where's the rest of it? No big deal. Oh my God. Sorry, that answer went to a weird place. One more question. Let's end on a high note of a nice question and a better answer I can give. Jen, you married me. You must have some questions. Yes? The most recent invention in history that's been invented earlier. It's probably not the most recent, but it's pretty recent, and that is recorded. Among the most recent. So recorded sound, it's an amazing story where we want to figure out how to record sound. And so someone figures out that they start dissecting human ears. And they're like, wow, you know, the human ear is basically a membrane that vibrates, and that moves some liquid that moves some hairs. So if we just took a membrane that vibrated, attached like a pen to it, and just like held a piece of glass over fire to make it black, and the pen just would move to that lamp black and trace shape, that would tell you what sound looks like. So they do this, and it works. And we spend over 10 years, almost 20 years, producing these. They were called sono autographs, sound writing itself, producing these images, and they were distributed, people would study them. 20 years when we realized, wait a minute, if this is a recorded sound, if you just ran that system backwards where the image moved the membrane through a pen, that would produce a sound wave. 20 years, and we're like, oh, no, okay, so we'll just do these in wax and make a wax cylinder. Now we have recorded sound. But a wax cylinder, like, we could have made that at any point in history, basically. You have bees, you can make a wax cylinder. It's not hard. It just took us so long to figure out, but also so long to like take that little baby step to the playable back recording sound. And so we have these images of sound that were recorded in the books. And it was only in 2008 that we thought, I bet you if we scan these and turn them into basically WAV files, we could play them back. And we could. And so the earliest recorded sound used to be a wax cylinder they'd done in tin. This guy who bought, because the earliest wax cylinder machines were, you could record and play back, so just different needles, one to cut and one to play. And so he had this big idea to make an invention of a talking clock that would play on the hour, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. We couldn't get it to work. All he got was a recording of himself going, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. But he skips number 9. So the earliest recorded sound at that point was a man trying and failing to count to 12, which I loved. But now the earliest sound that that's the earliest sound that can be played back in its own medium. The earliest sound we have is a Frenchman who's singing Clair de Lune. And since there was no cues as to what the playback speed was supposed to be, we thought it's either a man singing it very slowly or a woman singing it very quickly. And it took some extensive analysis to figure out, no, if he's singing it slowly because he wanted to see what the sound wave was. So that's a more beautiful earliest sound, a person singing rather than someone who can't count. But I love that, to answer your question, this could have been invented at any point in history, and it was invented very, very recently, and changed the world. The earliest sound, we thought, you know, we will hear ideas from any point in history. Now, when we start getting cinema, I remember reading this amazing article in Film Studies from when we first invented moving pictures, black and white. And this person was like, this is it. Like, we have conquered death. As soon as we have color video, we will have conquered death, because if you're sad that your loved one has died, just play a recording of them, and they'll be on your screen in color, dancing and singing and talking, and it'll be just like they're there. And I love, like, the optimism of that. Like, all you need to see this person, they'll be alive. And we know, like, it's not the case. It's better than nothing, but they haven't conquered death. But the idea of just thinking, like, it's 1920, and that's the last frontier, we'll have done it. Like, the optimism of the technology. I love that, and I love that it took us so long to get there. So I'm not sure that's the most recent, I'm sorry.
Maybe Don invented talking box in the 1400s.
Does anyone have one last question? that, I felt like that, and then I flipped around, so I thought, you know, I found all these points in history where we could have, we had everything we needed to invent something and didn't do it. All the parts were there, we couldn't put them together. Throughout human history, up to, you know, the 1920s. And given that, given all that data, the reasonable thing to conclude is that there are still things out there that 100 years from now, or 1,000 years from now, they'll be like, how did they not figure this out? And I love the idea that there are still, like, there's still this low-hanging fruit, there's still the stuff that anyone could invent and just have the idea to put these parts together in the right way. And I think, like, that's really optimistic. It's also very pessimistic, like, how can we be so stupid? But the optimism, like, there's still stuff to do, and there's still, like, we haven't run out of ideas, we haven't run out of inventions, we haven't run out of stuff that, like, anyone could tinker in their garage to help with this. You don't have to be a super programmer and, you know, build a new iPhone. You can do something like recorded sound that just takes that idea. I think that's really, that makes me feel good about myself. I don't think I'm going to be the person to invent any of this stuff, but I'm excited that the possibility is still out there. So, yeah, thank you for coming. Thank you.